everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bitcoin Banter. I've got Tony and Rick here with me. Gentlemen, how are you this morning?
Fantastic, Michael. How are you?
Doing well. We've got, some bad news to start with. So U.S. credit card debt has reached an all-time high of $1.14 trillion. I think this is just a typo here. 1.14, averaging $6,329 per person. And this is in a time that most people, I see different numbers, but you hear, you know, people can't afford a $400 expense or a $1,000 expense, like 80% of people or something crazy. So credit card debt is mounting. To me, this indicates desperation. Like they're, you know, basically trying to pay for their everyday life on their credit cards. Any initial reactions, Tony? Where does this lead?
Bad news, man. Where else would it lead? You know, when you have no money and you don't have access to a money printer, you know, in the basement, well, you know, how are you going to pay for stuff? At some point, there's only so many hours in a day that you can grind, right, before you burn out. And, you know, when enough people burn out and they still have to pay expenses and feed their kids or, you know, pay medical bills for sick members of the family, well, they're going to resort to whatever, you know, comes through their mind to find, you know, what they're looking for. And generally speaking, that is not good news, because that's, you know, I saw this in Lebanon. It's violence. It's good people end up doing bad things, and what they do is anybody's guess. So it is a very concerning piece of information. I mean, Lebanon is a small country, and I already have PTSD from what I've seen. I can't imagine this happening in the United States on a large scale like this. It's just the mere thought of it is petrifying.
Yeah. Rick?
Yeah. I mean, the numbers are just getting mind-boggling now, right? Like trillions. I think people lose sight of just how big a trillion is, right? I mean, these are seriously insane numbers. And the truth is, like, there's no way, there is absolutely no way that all of that money is getting paid back. It's simply not possible at this point. And what it reminds me of, like that the thing that stuck out to me in that tweet was, I think they mentioned like rising delinquencies as well. So more and more people not being able to actually like make the payments. Now that just reminds me, I don't know, I think a lot of Bitcoiners have probably seen that film. Was it The Big Short? Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So delinquencies have risen to 9.1%. So that means that on that $1.14 trillion worth of debt, 10% of people are already defaulting. Now, 10% sounds like a pretty big number to me, right? And I think we can only expect it to rise from there. And the reason it reminds me of that film, The Big Short, is because famously, like, Michael Burry kind of figured it out before a lot of other people by digging through all the data. And I think one of the things that stuck out to him that made him short the US housing market was the fact that delinquencies were going through the roof. And it was just weird, like no one was reporting on it, the market wasn't reacting to it. But I think that's what made him like really sit and figure out what was going on. So, you know, a rise in delinquency suggests that, like, who knows how long we can kick this can down the road. But yeah, people living on credit can only last for so long. So it's just another sign that we're getting closer and closer to that day when, you know, markets do go completely nuts, and it's going to happen.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So, talk about a country that's bounced back and forth on Bitcoin. So Vladimir Putin signed into a law, the legalization of cryptocurrency mining in Russia. And I think we all know that that means people are going to be mining Bitcoin and probably almost nothing else, if they have any level of intelligence. But this is a big oil and natural resource rich country. And I think, you know, a lot of times we lose sight, like we think of them as just kind of the enemy, but like they are very influential in markets. And we talked, I think, what was it, a week or two ago about him allowing, or I guess they passed some legislation allowing for use of Bitcoin in international trade. This to me is just like the game theory playing out. Any initial reactions?
Yeah, this is 100% game theory. I mean, the US couldn't have gifted Russia a nicer gift than to sanction them and weaponize the dollar against them. Because ever since they did that, they pulled that trigger, everything's been backfiring. You know, from from the money to them, you know, legalizing trade in Bitcoin, now the Bitcoin mining. I mean, what did you expect? You know, you want to try to choke someone. They're not going to just sit there and die, right? They're going to find a way around you. And unfortunately, for the U.S., we live in a time where Bitcoin was created. I mean, if we didn't have Bitcoin, I don't know what they would have done. Maybe resorted, you know, to the old-fashioned ways of gold and silver and, you know, and those types of assets. But now we really do have a game-changing technology, you know, that digital money, Bitcoin, which is uncontrollable by anyone and accessible to everyone. So I don't know how many times they banned it. They were bouncing back and forth, you know, deciding what they want to do. But ultimately, I think they've realized that they can't stop it. They can't do anything to stop anyone from using it. So they might as well adopt it and use it to their advantage to, you know, solidify their countries and, you know, keep their, you know, bring their economies back up to where they're supposed to be. And that's exactly what's going to happen. And now, a lot of people that are mining Bitcoin in other jurisdictions, there's a very strong possibility that they relocate their miners to Russia because the cost, the energy cost is extremely low there. So, for example, miners that are paying, you know, 7-8 cents a kilowatt in the US, they'd be paying 3-4 cents, for example, in Russia. So it's a no-brainer to shift a big portion of that overseas. And I suspect, you know, that's going to happen.
Rick, I want to hear your thoughts, but I also want to ask you, so do you think that this, like China and some of their allies, or at least more friendly nations, especially the larger ones like the BRICS, do you think this is like the beginning of a more mainstream adoption of Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining more specifically in those sorts of countries?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we talked, I think, on a previous podcast about the BRICS companies, BRICS countries, sorry. Yeah, and it makes perfect sense, right? Like Tony says, like Russia's an energy-rich country, right? And I think the reason maybe they flip-flopped a little bit is because Russia did have a problem a few years back when, you know, at the start of the Ukraine war, quite a lot of capital was trying to flee from Russia. So there was sort of an attempt by Russia to sort of stop capital flight. So, you know, they kind of wouldn't have seen Bitcoin in a great light because of that. But now, you know, as the game theory starts to sort of slowly play out, it's an inevitability if they're under sanctions that, like Tony says, they're going to find other ways to trade with each other, right? Yeah, and Russia has some really valuable things that other countries want, right? Like oil and gas. So, yeah, I mean, Russia's in a good position here to, first of all, like attract hash rate, like Tony says, and, you know, all this Bitcoin that will be mined in Russia. I mean, Putin says that you'll have to be on a designated list of entrepreneurs. So the government are going to have like quite a lot of control over the Bitcoin mining that happens there. And I think we're just starting to see these nation states start to understand that they're going to have to compete over this. Because on one side of the Atlantic, you've got Donald Trump talking about Bitcoin strategic reserves. And now you're seeing sort of Russia on the other side of it trying to get involved as well. I think they're almost there, but maybe not fully there yet. And why I think that is like they're still working on this thing called the BRICS Bridge, which is some nonsense blockchain thing that they're coming up with where they can create a new currency to trade with each other on the which is obviously nonsense, right? And you know, they talk about other cryptocurrencies when they talk about this mining bill as well. But, you know, that's just the thin end of the wedge, right? Like we've all seen it amongst like loads of people before. You start with thinking, oh, cryptocurrencies, and you do a bit of shitcoining alongside your Bitcoining and all this. And listen, once they're on that road, there's no getting off it, right? They're not going to go backwards to fiat. So listen, they might mess around a little bit, launch a couple of rubbish projects and blockchain this. And, you know, it seems like they're still figuring it out a little bit. But, you know, attracting hash rate, legalizing mining, the signal for all of us out here is that, like, you know, I mean, the doubt has to be diminishing around what Bitcoin is and what it represents. You know, if this is a game of musical chairs and you start seeing nation states taking a seat, you've got to think like, okay, well, you know, I need to get a seat for myself as well and worry about what I'm doing. But yeah, crazy development. Yeah.
I'll paraphrase. I think it's Saifedean who says you can't outrun the best money forever. And I think this is what we're seeing. They're continuing to sort of outrun it by, you know, crypto and you know, maybe some sort of BRICS blockchain currency or whatever. But at the end of the day, El Salvador has already set that precedent, and they're small enough that you can ignore it for a period of time. If that was the U.S., I mean, no one would be ignoring it anymore. But I think we're beginning to see this play out now, where we're just inching toward that. You can't beat it, so you've got to join it. So hopefully that's a positive development and in Bitcoin's adoption on a global stage.
Hey there, just a really quick break from Bitcoin Banter, and we'll be right back. Wanted to remind you that we, the Bitcoin Way, are the leaders in achieving self-sovereignty, whether it's self-custodying your Bitcoin properly and securely, protecting your online life and keeping it private, or even coming up with a plan B option in the event you would need to move yourself or your family elsewhere. Go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast to schedule a few minutes to learn more from a member of our team. We hope to see you soon.
We've got some more good news. Well, depending on how you take this, but in terms of institutional adoption, Morgan Stanley has given the green light to their 15,000 advisors to sell Bitcoin ETFs, and he says it, you know, it's only a matter of time before it gets traction. I've got a friend who is an advisor at Morgan Stanley, really smart guy, but hasn't figured out Bitcoin, doesn't understand it. He's so consumed by like, well, I don't understand like what it's doing or why it's important. It just kind of goes up and it's volatile and everything. But 15,000 advisors, I imagine there are some of them that have read the Bitcoin Standard or have watched some podcasts who kind of get it. And I have to imagine that they're going to have a competitive advantage even amongst their peers, because they're going to be proactive in promoting this. But it could be a little while, I guess, before 15,000 people are talking about it with their clients. What do you think the timeline is on this being a meaningful development? Is this something that in the next month or the next year or a couple of years that we see really take hold in like the average investor's portfolio because of the advisors getting on board?
I don't think it's going to take that long. I mean, I'd be very surprised if these 15,000 sharks weren't, you know, put in a room and hardcore trained about Bitcoin and how to sell this as efficiently as possible. I mean, I don't think Morgan Stanley is going to unleash 15,000, you know, brain dead human beings that know nothing and try to sell this successfully. They're going to, you know, give them all the information that they need and make sure that they have at least a minimum understanding of what it is that they're promoting to their clients. Now, like you said, Michael, some of them may already have a head start on this, have read the books, may already be Bitcoiners themselves, but, you know, have stayed quiet in the background because it was against company policy to talk about this. Well, now they have the green light, so to speak, and they can talk about this all day, and it's actually part of their duties. So this is extremely bullish for Bitcoin adoption. I mean, once the word goes out and once people see that the asset is appreciating in value, even though initially most of them are going to be looking at number go up, you know, which is the most meaningless metric, but, you know, that's what attracts the most at this stage. Everybody's going to be FOMOing in. And this is what we're seeing, whether it's governments, whether it's institutions, you know, everybody, the slowly to suddenly has happened a lot quicker than I thought it would. And it happened, like, it seems like it's happening overnight. You know, it's not like it took a while. It's like something happened, and now everybody, every day you almost hear something big going on. And so now you've got Morgan Stanley, you add that to BlackRock, you add like the Fidelity, and like these are not Mickey Mouse players, right? So the 15,000 sharks that are going to be out there, I'm fairly certain they're going to pretty much forget about everything else that they've been doing at Morgan Stanley and focus on this one, because this is going to be the biggest moneymaker. And these guys are about profits.
Yeah, definitely, Rick.
Yeah, well, I don't have much more to add than Tony. You know, like 15,000 advisors from Morgan Stanley charging around selling Bitcoin ETF shares. They're going to have some success, right? These are highly trained professionals who sell financial products all day, every day. So yeah, it's going to have an impact. What I would just say to, you know, like everyday people is understand that these people aren't actually selling Bitcoin. Right. They're not selling Bitcoin. They're mm-hmm. selling ETF shares. Right. Which means that you can never withdraw that Bitcoin. right? It's not Bitcoin, it's Bitcoin Lite. It gives you exposure to the price of Bitcoin, right? But it doesn't give you the actual asset. You know, you can't withdraw it. There's no transparency. There's no censorship resistance. You can't transact with it. There's no freedom, like Bitcoin without the freedom, right? Which is kind of crazy, right? And also, you know, there's a couple of other things I think people don't think about enough when it comes to buying ETF shares is like, first of all, when these ETFs go and buy that Bitcoin, they're going to go and use Coinbase as their custodian, right? And something like, I don't know if I get these figures right, but like 80% of the ETFs are keeping their Bitcoin in Coinbase, as I understand it, right? Just huge amounts, all in this single point of failure. Wow, that's a juicy honeypot, right? Do you know what I'm saying? And hey, listen, Coinbase has some history here, right? Like they have had data breaches before. Back in 2021, they had a data breach where they lost 6,000 customer details. Now, they didn't lose any Bitcoin, right? But the point is that these are not like impenetrable fortresses. So you've got to think that like on a long enough timeline, could be 50 years, could be 100, for all I know, having all this Bitcoin sitting in a honeypot is risky, A, from hackers, but also what I'd like to remind people of is, you know, the government, right? You know, like, you know, the government, yeah. These guys, you know how we all use Bitcoin because it's like government free money, right? Like this is the whole point in the first place, right? Ever since like 2009. Well, having all this Bitcoin in a honeypot at Coinbase's disposal puts it well within the reach of the US government. And I'd re remind people of, you know, what Roosevelt did in 1993, right? Where Executive Order 6102 came out and they basically made it illegal for private citizens to hold gold. And they forced the US citizens to come and exchange their gold. And they only, by the way, gave them something like $21 per troy ounce when they did it. So they ripped them off in the process. Right before actually later on, they then revalued the dollar and set gold at $35 a troy ounce, which is like more than 60% higher than the price that they just paid everybody. So I don't know what's going to happen, but what I might suggest is like, if it doesn't sound entirely crazy to you, that one day the US government might say something like, we need to take ownership of that Bitcoin because it's an issue of you know, extreme national security. Hey, listen, I can almost hear the news anchors saying it, right? So yeah, I would never buy Bitcoin ETF shares because it's not Bitcoin. In fact, you couldn't really get that much further away from Bitcoin. All you're really getting is exposure to the price. So yeah, I mean, if you want to. The last thing I'll say on this actually, because the one bit of pushback you'll get from people is, oh, but my pension is already wrapped up, right? And this allows me to get exposure to Bitcoin, but in a tax efficient way, right? Because if I withdraw the money from my pension and buy real Bitcoin and self custody it, I'll be down 20% because of all the taxes or something, right? Well, over the last like 10 years, we've talked about this before, like Bitcoin's performance is in the thousands of percent, right? And if it demonetizes everything and becomes the reserve currency globally, then the upside in terms of its value is still enormous. So if you're going to take all of this counterparty risk that I just talked about for the sake of saving 20%, when the thesis is that Bitcoin's going to, you know, increased by many, many multiples, then what you're doing is the very definition of trying to pick up pennies in front of a steamroller. It's crazy, right? So I know that might sound a bit extreme to say, sort of like, well, this is just what I would do. I would only be interested in real Bitcoin in self-custody. And I think the ETFs, no matter how hard Morgan Stanley sell them, are not the way to go.
Well, that's what a
At
lot
the
of
end of the
people are
day, I think.
doing
Oh,
already, by
go.
the way. Sorry, Michael. Yeah, just a
No.
point to go back to what Rick was saying. A lot of folks are doing this, by the way. They are taking the tax hit in order to have the long-term bet on having Bitcoin in self-custody, because those that are thinking and you know along the lines of the taxes and all that, they're not really they don't understand money, and they certainly don't understand Bitcoin and what it represents and what its long-term value is. So those that do, as much as it sucks in the moment to pay that 20, 30% tax hit, they will make it back, you know, exponentially going forward, holding, you know, the real asset in self-custody. And when that day comes, you know, whatever amount they paid in taxes will be a blip in their memory. They won't even recall what it is that they paid. Morgan Stanley and all these institutions selling ETFs, it's great to fast track, you know, the paying attention to Bitcoin. At some point, you know, you have to assume that a certain percentage of these people start off knowing nothing, but you'd hope that at some point they pick up a few tips and opt out and, you know, want to hold the asset, you know, themselves. A large majority of them, you know, well, whatever, if they have to learn this the hard way, so be it. But the idea that these companies are in this space, I don't see it as a bad thing. You know, I see it as a bad thing for those that don't understand what to do ultimately. But I see it as a very good thing to attract the attention of those that will never look at Bitcoin unless they get the permission of these big institutions.
My opinion is that people have been conditioned, so conditioned, for two things: accumulate more fiat. And so the notion of Bitcoin is something worth acquiring, it just isn't even on their radar. And second is taking on counterparty risk. Most people don't even, like your like investors, like professional investors, hedge funds, they understand counterparty risk. My best friend, like most of my family, they do not understand counterparty risk. And they don't recognize that, even just like your local bank, that is counterparty risk. They don't have your money, right? Much less when I buy Bitcoin ETFs, that there is underlying Bitcoin to that. And 90% of it is in one single place, right? I mean, Coinbase has all of that. And the counterparty risk is, as you touched on, Rick, I mean, it's the attack vector that Coinbase faces from a security perspective, but it's also government intervention and co-opting of Coinbase. And, you know, and like Coinbase, they're kind of close source, right? Like we don't know what's going on there, and it would be very easy for them to be in cahoots with the government, you know, much less, you know, the government intervening in some more intrusive way. So for anyone listening, I mean, think hard about that. Do you, 20 years from now, do you want more dollars, which are guaranteed to lose value, or do you want more Bitcoin, which is mathematically programmed to increase in value as adoption rates increase? And so you're betting on basically Bitcoin adoption continuing in an upward trajectory. And that's really it. That's all you have to bank on. So yeah, word of caution to anyone listening who's thinking about the ETFs. And I agree with you, Rick. The one pushback I'd provide is there are people who, you know, certainly older people who need to pay the bills today, and having cash flow and in their local fiat is just a practical reality. So I think ETFs are a great option if that's your world, but I think you shouldn't resort to that as like, well, that's my Bitcoin, because it's not Bitcoin. It's without all of the freedoms that you talked about. Okay, last one. So this is more of a fun one because we're a Bitcoin security company effectively. So is your car spying on you? This is not something that the Bitcoin Way helps with, by the way, quick disclaimer, but I'm going to play this. If you can't hear this, let me know. I'll make sure on the video that we share, it'll be.
Is your car spying audible on you? Here's how to check. You see, I just purchased a Toyota 4Runner after 18 years of driving a Honda Element. It was like a brick phone on wheels, but now I'm driving a smartphone with all kinds of tracking technology. So the first thing I did before even leaving the dealership was turn off as much data collection as possible. I downloaded the manufacturer's app, entered my VIN, and then declined all connected services features. These wirelessly transmit my location and vehicle health to Toyota. Then I went to vehicleprivacyreport.com, entered my VIN, and I about died when I saw all the tracking still on my car. My 4Runner collects identifiers like my name, mailing address, email, and demographic info. It also collects biometrics, including my geolocation, driver's license, and financial info. And I learned my car not only tracks my data, it sells it too. My car sells information to affiliates like sponsors, partners, and advertisers. It shares my data with service providers and its affiliated insurance company, but only if I've provided consent. which I don't remember doing. And finally, it should come as a surprise to no one that car companies will share your data with the government when legally obligated to do so. So I opted out of targeted advertising, the sharing or selling of my data, and any marketing communications. Now check your car's privacy and let me know.
So, I am only going to be driving dumb cars for the rest of my life. The dumber, the better, as long as it is fueled and takes me from point A to point B. Tony, I want to hear your comments first.
I haven't studied, you know, car surveillance, but I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if this was happening. I mean, we live in a world where everything is surveilled. It's by design how it's being put together. I mean, a few years back during, you know, the pandemic, there was talk about passing a law to force all electronic cars to have a kill switch. And then, you know, at the same time, they wanted to pass a law to abolish gas cars and to force everybody into electric cars so that, you know, in case, you know, they needed to click, you know, nobody would be able to run away anymore. Like that whole, you know, dystopian world of surveillance and control. I mean, that's what these crazy people are putting the pieces in place for. You're just seeing it. Like people are discovering it now because they're finally paying attention to things that have been there for a long time. I don't think car surveillance is new. I mean, this chick discovered this now, but this technology has been around for many, many years, but nobody was, you know, thinking about this or really giving it, you know, any attention. Up until now, some reason the world is waking up and, you know, people are going down rabbit holes and uncovering, you know, the real dystopian world that we live in. And it's not a pretty picture, unfortunately. And this is how we do change, man. The more people stumble upon these bad surprises, the more, you know, reaction you get. And hopefully, you know, collectively, we put an end to it.
And we're back to counterparty risk again, right? Like, mm-hmm. Maybe you think you can trust Tesla or, you know, pick your car company. Maybe you think that, you know, Elon Musk would never. But once you're one subpoena away from all of your information being in complete custody of the government, if it's not already. Right. So even if you think you found like the trusted car company who is never going to intentionally, you know, leak anything. Doesn't matter if they're in a jurisdiction that chooses to intervene, you know, you're toast. Rick?
I mean, this is why today I just get around by donkey. and if the Bitcoin price does well, then I might upgrade to a horse, right? But no. I mean, jokes aside, right? Like, the thing I find amusing watching that video is, well, you know, okay, so she's gone and turned off all this tracking or whatever for her car, right? But then I'm sure she's about to climb in that car with her mobile phone in her pocket. And I'm pretty sure the mobile phone tracks her location everywhere she's going, pinging off every cell tower she drives past. So, you know, I guess if that was the first time I'd seen a video like that, it's maybe like, well, it's maybe not that much worse than what you're already doing, because if your phone's in your pocket 24 hours a day and you're not protecting your location on that, then they always know where you are. And like Tony said, I mean, they've been tracking vehicles for ages. You know, you probably don't have this in the US because it's such a large country, right? But almost every major road in the UK now has something called ANPR, which is automatic number plate recognition technology. So, man, like, listen, you, even if you had a dumb car, right, that just runs on petrol, it's not really going to help you in the UK, because like as soon as you go on a motorway anywhere, like this stuff is registering your number plate. I mean, there are things that you can do, like you can buy these things called stealth plates that you can put on your car instead of a regular number plate. The problem is all the police cars are also fitted with ANPR. And if they end up behind you on the motorway and they can't read your plate, then, you know, you're pulled over, fined. Obviously, they don't want you doing that and it's illegal and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I think if you're just going to panic about your car, you probably need to think a bit broader than that and think about your phones, your laptops and everything else. I think probably actually, you know, I think everybody probably underestimates the kind of technology the governments have access to now to track you and understand where you are. I mean, your fridge is listening to you, your TV's listening to you. You know, your Ring security camera on your house is filming you every time you come and go. Who comes around to your house for a party on Friday night? Like all of that stuff. So, yeah, it's scary, and I guess just shows us, like, you know, you've got to take your privacy way more seriously, because, you know, it feels fairly innocuous, right? Like, oh, who cares if Toyota knows where I am in my car today? But, you know, in the hands of the wrong person, that's pretty bad information to give away. And obviously, you know, just like everything, they sell it, don't they, without asking your permission. So it's just greed again, just pushing all of this. And just like we talked about with Coinbase holding all the ETFs Bitcoin, you know, the government can lean on Coinbase, and I'm sure, you know, they're going to lean on car manufacturers as well. You know, these businesses are not going to turn around and tell the government to back off. They're just going to comply. So, yeah, I don't know what the solution to that one is. Another suggestion I've always wanted to try is, have you boys ever seen these paramotors where you can basically stick a giant fan on your back and have a big, like, canopy, and you can just fly around? You only need a little two-stroke motor. So maybe that's the way to go. I don't know.
Yeah, until you see people smashing into segue. Trees.
That's a good segue into a shameless plug for the Bitcoin Way. So to all of our listeners, if any of this is surprising to you, or you need help with protecting your online privacy, we help with that. Obviously, pure unbridled self-custody of your Bitcoin. And we have a new service for de-Googled phones. So if you want a privacy-oriented phone, we can help you with that as well. And of course, if you're just somewhere that you need to get out, such as Rick in the UK, we've got Plan B options for you. So go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We'd love to chat with you, help you consider your options. And with that, I think we've just wrapped up another good episode of Bitcoin Banter. Gentlemen, thanks for taking time. We'll be back next week.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. Cheers, everyone.